data which they're keeping simply for business purposes, or is any of this leaching out to the Israeli intelligence services? That's the question I would ask.
I mean, Loki, now that Proofpoint's acquired these companies, can you explain what the connection is with the Israeli military and intelligence, and why that's problematic? I mean, you did say that they're kind of located right next door. I mean, just tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, specifically, when we look at an organization like FireLayers, FireLayers was started by two veterans of the Israeli tech unit in the Israeli military, but also just a year before FireLayers was acquired by Proofpoint, FireLayers attended an invitation-only conference from the Institute for National Security Studies, which is led by former Israeli intelligence figures. And the conference itself was actually funded by several Israeli government ministries, including the Ministry of Intelligence. It was described as a synergetic hub through which ties could be built between private and public companies, between Israel and the United States. In addition to that, you have Meta Networks, which was founded by Alan Horowitz, who, as was said in the report, had such a high-ranking position within the Israeli military that he had to take a polygraph test every few years. So what's clear is that these organizations, and the important point to make here, is that their employees became employees of Proofpoint. There's not an arm's-length relationship between Proofpoint and these companies. They were subsumed fully into Proofpoint. So when Proofpoint delivers email filtering services to an outlet like the Washington Post or CNN, who, by the way, both of them have recently published work around the killing of Shirin Abu Akleh, for example, CNN, concluding late though it was, that it's most likely that the Israeli military killed Shirin Abu Akleh. When those emails are going back and forth, who is having access to them? That is the key question here.
No, indeed. And David, I mean, we regularly discuss the Israel occupation forces and the intelligence services on this show, don't we? And I get the feeling that these are much more active in society than we might have imagined. I mean, is that true?
Well, I think that I myself as being rarely shocked when I come across Western intelligence agencies active in some nefarious doings. But the fact that they are involved in even apparently neutral tech companies is quite stunning, really, isn't it? I mean, there seems to be Israeli intelligence, and indeed the intelligence agencies of other Western countries, the US, the UK and others, involved in very, very many areas of life which you wouldn't think were the activities of intelligence agencies, in companies, in private companies, in civil society groups and charities. And it's really much more extensive as an area of activity than perhaps we think of. Maybe we have seen James Bond films when we were younger, or we've read the stuff about the intelligence services, the history of the CIA or MI6 and MI5 and Mossad. But the expansion of the intelligence agencies into almost all areas of life, I think, is something really quite remarkable, and seems to have been accomplished much more intensively in the last decade or so.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, Loki, that the Israeli government, you know, seems to be, as it were, arm's lengthing, you know, privatizing almost their sort of intelligence operations. If you know what you're saying about these companies is correct. I mean, what's going on? I mean, is this to sort of, as it were, avoid, blame, responsibility, culpability for some of the nefarious activities that these organisations are getting up to on their behalf?
So it's been specific policy since 2012. You've had the founding in what they call Beersheba, a cyber tech unit which exists directly alongside Unit 8200. It's important for us to clarify what Unit 8200 is. It's the signals intelligence unit in the IDF, founded in the 50s, over 1,500 members of it. But what it focuses on doing is surveilling the electronic communication of Palestinians. It's been referred to as Israel's big brother. There have been whistleblowers within it, and alumni of it that have come out and signed a letter saying what they are doing is using information to blackmail Palestinians into collaboration. It's sort of an omnipotent surveillance entity which is formed around the occupation, and it buttresses that physical seizing of the land. It's the seizing of information. And so this is the unit from which so much of this comes. And I'm sure we'll get into in a moment some of the other organizations that have serious question marks around them, especially when you take into account the history of Israeli spying on the United States specifically.
I mean, just finally, before we go to the next VT, it was interesting, wasn't it? I think it was last year that the Labour Party, Sir Keir Starmer, appointed a former 8200 operative to head up the Labour Party's social media activities. I don't know if you've got any thoughts about that.
Precisely, and Asaf Kaplan's supposed function within the Labour Party is social listening. Now, in the context of Labour functioning as an internal surveillance system, which disqualifies people from political subjectivity in this country, what is the significance of us having somebody directly coming from Unit 8200 and being there to essentially police the social media profiles of possible members of the party and others?
Indeed. Interesting question, but we'll pause there for a moment because I want to just have a look at this report on how Proofpoint got involved in using its access to client data to engage in propaganda against Palestinians.
Prior to subsuming these three Israeli startups, US company Proofpoint had no history of spotting hacks allegedly linked to the Islamic Republic of Iran or the Palestinian resistance. But since the acquisitions, the company has taken a special interest in this subject.
Iran has been of special interest because of the tensions in the Middle East that have risen over the past several months. When Proofpoint talks about APT actors, what we mean is advanced persistent threat actors. State-sponsored APT actors typically have the backing and financial resources of a nation state, meaning they have access to the most advanced tools. What's really important for organizations to understand about Iranian APT threat groups is that they are incredibly sophisticated and they have a long history of attacking targets in the United States and in their own backyard in the Middle East. The Iranian actors that we track have lots of specific trademarks that allow us to attribute their activity.
Proofpoint has also sought to blame the besieged people of Gaza by reporting on what it claims is Palestinian-aligned espionage. The Proofpoint report into supposed Palestinian hacking was written by former German government employee Konstantin Klinger and former FBI agent Joshua Miller, who is simultaneously a Proofpoint researcher and a reserve captain in the US military. Another Proofpoint report targeting the Islamic Republic of Iran was authored by former BAE Systems employee Michael Raggi and Krista Gehring, herself a former employee of the CIA. An additional report on supposed Palestinian hacking was co-authored by someone who went from working as a journalist for CNN to working for Proofpoint, Selena Larson. She's also a fellow of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs, which features John M. Deutsch, the former director of the CIA, on its board. It seems doubtful that a company full of former Israeli spies and current reserves in the U.S. Army can be taken as a neutral authority on these matters.
David, this is all very murky, isn't it? I mean, this company acquires Israel-based firms with strong intelligence connections. Then it starts leveraging its access to client data to produce what appears to be uncheckable stories about alleged Iranian and Palestinian hacking operations. I mean, what do you make of this?
Well, it's an extraordinary part of the story. I mean, the stuff we've talked about already about its involvement with Israeli intelligence is worrying enough. But the fact that they're now leveraging the information that they're getting from clients for by whatever means to push pro-Israel propaganda stories, which have a clearly very little basis in fact, is extremely worrying. I mean, this is the point. This is not just surveillance and the use of surveillance and the outsourcing of surveillance to private companies on behalf of Israeli intelligence. It's also the weaponization of that information to intimidate and to try and force individuals into particular courses of action. It's a propaganda operation, and it's much more than just surveillance as we currently think of it. It's about, you know, actually intervening in the society and trying to influence it.
Mm. I mean, I wonder, Loki, whether we could pick up on the point that you were talking about this unit 8200 and elaborate a little bit more. I mean, it's an obscure intelligence agency, isn't it? I mean, just say a little bit more about that, because people, I think, will be interested to find out.
Well, I think the key thing to understand here is that in terms of the people that do the cybersecurity for Lockheed Martin, the people that do the cybersecurity for Leidos, the people that do the cybersecurity for several Department of Defense classified databases, the companies were founded by former members of Unit 8200. Of course, the article that I mentioned in Calculus Tech, which passed through the Israeli military censor, made clear that Black Cube, for example, was set up to function in this way by former Unit 8200 people. When we look at the company that does the cybersecurity for the Lockheed Martin and Leidos stuff, it's Cyber Reason. Now, Cyber Reason, again, was set up by former Unit 8200 people. The CEO of Cyber Reason actually said in an interview in TechCrunch that his work in Cyber Reason was a continuation of his work in Unit 8200. Now, just when we take into account Lockheed Martin is key US defense contractor. It carried out the census in this country in 2010, 2011. Leidos also had involvement in the census more recently. But if we think historically from Robert Maxwell pushing the Promise software into the United States to be used essentially for Israel to spy on its nuclear development in the US, also, we have the example of Jonathan Pollard placing a backdoor in US computer systems in order for it to be used by Israeli intelligence. When we also take into account that even the White House, Bill Clinton's phone line was tapped by Israeli intelligence in the 90s, which gave them pre-knowledge of the Monica Lewinsky scandal, what you're talking about is the number one entity which spies on the United States now having access through Cyber Reason to several very important, potentially having access to several very important classified databases. For example, with the pandemic, you saw the setting up of the Cyber Threat Intelligence League, which was founded by Ohad Zeidenberg, again, a former Unit 8200 member. Now, this gentleman simultaneously works for an organization which is funded by the Israeli regime. And also, what you have to understand about the Cyber Threat Intelligence League is it offered pro bono cybersecurity to places of importance in the United States, like nuclear plants, chemical reactors, dams, hospitals, the health service. And in many cases, it was granted that access to deliver pro bono, free of charge cybersecurity. Now, were this any other entity, were this any other intelligence organization that had this type of umbilical-like role with these companies, there is no way that you would see this level of access to information, certainly not in the United States.
No, indeed. Well, from what you're saying, it sounds kind of almost ubiquitous Israeli intelligence operation throughout the globe. But David, let me come to you. I mean, these stories remind me a bit about the widespread claims of Russian hacking and Russian disinformation. Is there a parallel, do you think, with this?
Very much so. I mean, this whole idea that our enemies are engaged in hacking and hack and leak operations, as it's been said in the UK in recent weeks, or that they are engaged in disinformation. It's a huge disinformation industry which now exists to point out alleged Russian or Chinese disinformation. And almost all of it, practically all of it, is actually funded by Western defense and security interests. It's actually about distracting attention from the actual disinformation which is pushed out by Western governments. And it's the same with the Israelis. There are Israeli backed disinformation monitors in this country as well. And this operation here to try and direct attention to Palestinian espionage or to the Iranians' alleged role. This is the same kind of thing. It's the same playbook that's being used in this country, for example, with the recent Masongate story, where a British journalist, left-wing journalist, Paul Mason, was engaged in the direct communications with MI6 to suggest that they should target rogue left academics who might be critical of the government's policy on Ukraine. And of course, the way in which those kinds of ideas come out about these rogue academics, these are coming directly from not Putin talking points, but MI6 talking points, who, and we actually see now that these talking points exist, that the, in this case, the handler for Paul Mason, a guy called Andy Price, actually, you know, sends by email to his contacts a list of things he'd like to push out. And that's all the latest stories on, for example, on Ukraine or in previous cases on Russia, Russia's alleged disinformation or Russia's actions. So much of what we see in the mainstream press, like these hacker stories from Proofpoint, is actually talking points from the intelligence services of Israel, the US and the UK.
Well, I mean, these are very troubling accusations, for sure, aren't they? And I wonder, Loki, whether you might be able to say a bit more and perhaps maybe give us some other examples of companies that are perhaps engaged in similar activities. I mean, are there other companies engaged in similar activities, that is?
Well, so, for example, we have had one of the most glaring examples recently, which has not been seized upon, unfortunately, by many of us and also the media at all. You know, the NSO group pushing this Pegasus spyware across the planet, claiming that it has no access to the information that is gleaned from these devices through the Pegasus spyware. On top of that, you have British Gas actually investing its employees' pensions into the NSO group's stuff. You had key figures in British civil society, thousands of journalists, human rights defenders across the planet having their phones hacked by Pegasus spyware. And I think the key thing to understand is that actually NSO group, rather than being distant from the Israeli government as some tried to depict it in the beginning, it's actually been revealed to be an arm of the Israeli regime. And so here we see this massive, as you say, ubiquitous network of surveillance infrastructure, which is essentially about the war over data. And I think very much so, the data war is actually bigger than the physical war for on land. And so we really have to cultivate a criticality about this among supporters of Palestinian rights.
Indeed. Well, I'm sure it's a topic that we will return to on this show. Thanks for joining us today, Loki, and thank you to David, who joined us from Bristol today because of the rail strike. I wasn't able to be in the studio with me as normal, but I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there now, as unfortunately we're out of time. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to the IRIB English Radio, and this is the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their offspring. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. We have with us in studio today our guest speaker, Brother Al-Musawi. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
All right, Brother Musawi, we have been talking about the signs that parents could look for that indicate them that their child is going through a problem. To give a little summary, you said in the previous episode that some behaviors parents could notice, like biting nails, sucking thumbs, urinating in the bed, checking the anger level of their children, just seeing that if their kids are violent with others, fighting and not reacting, and you said like being obedient all the time is also one of the problems. And you said that family environment also plays a great role. If a child sees parents fighting with each other and does not react, there's a problem. And if he even reacts, he loses respect for either of his parents.
Yeah. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So we will continue with where we left off last time.
Yeah.
So looking at the signs which are in the environment, which is the house, basically. And sometimes what we do as parents will affect our children directly in terms of their behavior. So sometimes instead of blaming the child himself for things, sometimes we should blame ourselves. Or instead of trying to fix the child, we should definitely fix our own mistakes. So, for example, sometimes when you have family issues, whether it is, God forbid, a violence towards one of the parents between themselves and the spouses, or there are constant fights and constant arguments, it creates such an environment for the child, it becomes so much pressure and negativity in the child's mind that it makes the child run away. So we have a lot of runaway children, or children who sometimes, in a lot of countries, especially in the West, where they end up calling child services themselves, or sometimes you see them complaining to their teachers, and in return, the teachers would call child services, and then they end up losing the child altogether. So sometimes all these kids who leave the house or run away from the house, or at least not permanently, at least for a while, like they just don't want to be in the house, is because there's so much pressure inside that the child doesn't want to face all this drama. Because you got to keep in mind, they're still young children, be it males or females.
Yeah.
The girls are more sensitive to this issue than the boys. The boys, sometimes they might just overlook it. But with girls, they're very sensitive. And especially if the mother is involved, like if the violence or arguments or fights are against the mother, because children are more attached to their mothers than their fathers. So that causes them a lot of mental stress.
Yeah.
So sometimes that leads the child to leave the house and and stay for long times outside the house. For example, he spends a lot of time with his friends. Or sometimes you have kids just staying outside the door. They just sit outside or play outside. They just don't want to come inside. Or sometimes they express that being away, not physically, but I mean going outside the house, but they lock themselves in their own rooms. They don't want to interact with the parents or with the family. So that indicates there's a problem, at least with the parents themselves, that they need to make sure that they fix and take care of.
All right. So there's a problem with the parents sometimes. If they're fighting, they need to behave themselves first before they start behaving their children. And if we see that the child is not interacting more with the family, he's spending more time outside or locking himself in their room, there is a problem your child is going through. Well, brother, I'll be talking to you, but after a very short break, dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. We are talking about Islamic upbringing and the signs which could help you that indicate your child is going through some problem. Yes, brother, you said like sometimes children lock up themselves in their room and spend less time with their families.
Yeah. So another sign that we have to look for, or at least to be mindful for, is that, and this is something that a lot of parents complain about, is that their child is too noisy, they're making too much problems in the house, they're fighting too much with their brothers, they're causing a lot of, friction, they're constantly crying, constantly angry.
Mm-hmm.
So all these issues that happens in the house, if it's constant, then we know there's a problem.
Okay.
Because normally, and generally speaking, the child should be at peace with his brothers and sisters. Yes, they do fight from time to time, obviously because there's a conflict,
right.
But it shouldn't be constant. Because
there
sometimes
should not be a constant
yeah,
fight.
Sometimes you have kids constantly fighting with each other. Or for example, if one of the children constantly bullying the other child.
Well, you remind me of one of the questions I myself must have.
Mm.
My brother-in-law has a son, and when he comes home, they start fighting. They definitely do fight, my son and his son. They're like around 7 years old, and whenever they, we cannot leave them anywhere alone. We know that they are going to fight.
Mm.
But when it comes to outside, they're like dumb. They cannot fight with other children, but they make so huge fights among each other. So I think that could also indicate something.
It definitely, see, because we're talking about the family itself, so because they are related in a way.
Yeah.
So the issue is like it's a very personal issue to one another.
Yeah.
So there's definitely a reason for them to be fighting constantly. So it's no longer, I mean, if he goes out with other children, he's fine. But especially when he's with that particular person, he's fighting. So it's like I said, you have to diagnose the situation. So you could see either it's a problem. Initiates from hate. Is it a hate factor that he just hates that child?
Right.
Is it because he thinks he's better than him? Is it because that child, for example, has things that he does not have?
Right.
Is it because he is more valued by his parents and this guy he feels like he's not valued himself?
Right.
So he starts to compare himself to this child, and once he sees that he's not as good as him, naturally it comes out in a form of an argument, in a form of a fight. So it's not natural. In natural cases, in general cases, they should get along very well, especially if they are close in age.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they should be interacting with each other. But if they are not, then there's definitely a cause.
Though they are always, but there's this fight always that takes place. I mean, if for example, if I'm going out and buying something for my kid, there's definitely my kid telling me why you're not buying for my cousin, all right? So I have to always buy two in place of one. I have to buy two. So he's so much caring about him. But at the same time, whenever they come, they meet, hi, hello, they hug each other in a way, like we say, they will never fight. But I don't know, all of a sudden, as fight erupts and parents have to, you know, drag them, please stop it. Yeah.
Yeah, so like I said, it's definitely, there's a trigger point, as we say, that's triggering this fight.
Yes.
Like I said.
So I would want to ask you, what's that triggering point? But after a very short break, dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya muqiy al-khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "A righteous child is indeed a flower from the flowers of paradise."
Ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya muqiy al-khayrat.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the signs that parents should look for if their children are fighting or if there's something wrong with the children. So we were talking about fight between kids, and you were saying that there could be some points that could be triggering.
Yeah. So like I said, when you look at a specific case, like I said, you will find the trigger point very easily if you start to compare and look at the environment. So for example, now you just mentioned the fact that your child for example, you buy something for him, so he has to buy something for his cousin. So he ends up giving a toy to his cousin. That itself, from a child's perspective, obviously, from a child's point of view, he looks at it as him being, I'm not sure if I could use the word degraded, he feels that he's less worthy. Because, I mean, sometimes I give you a gift when you are very well off is one thing. But sometimes I give you something because I know you're in need of it. All so right. naturally you'll feel like, okay, I am at a loss. Let's say I am poor and you're giving me a handout. So as much as from where you're standing, you're actually helping me. But from where I am, I see it as, you know, I'm being... someone else is trying to take care of me. You know what I mean? So that naturally makes me feel low at some stage.
All right.
So maybe like 5 minutes after we're talking with each other, and then it comes out. You know, once this greetings and all this formality goes away, then my true nature comes out.
All right.
So this could be, like I said, it could be a trigger. Sometimes, like I said, if the other child, if he looks at your child and he compares himself with his parents, for example, he sees that you're very nice to your child.
All right.
You're very respecting towards your child, but he sees a difference from his parents as well.
All right.
So all these things, like I said, even mentally and subconsciously, they have accumulated in a child himself. Like I said, so you need to study not only your child's behavior, but you need to study the other child's behavior.
Check your behavior.
So what happens is they accumulate them. And at some point... it just comes out. It just blows up.
Yeah.
And like I said, when a child expresses his emotional state or his mental state, it comes because he's a child, so he's not going to sit like me and you and discuss it logically.
Yeah.
It will come in a form of, let's say, like I said, in a form of a fight.
Fight.
In a form of disobedience. In a form of breaking something. In a form of creating, a scene.
Yeah.
That's a child's way of expressing that there's a problem. So like I said, so when we look at this specific case that you're going through, definitely there are, like I said, trigger points. But you, because you know the family very well, you know your child very well, you know the cousin very well.
I need to analyze it myself. Really.
So you have to analyze what might be going wrong. Sometimes it could be even a simple issue. For example, a lot of parents, for example, when they talk to their children, they talk to them always from an authoritative voice.
Yeah.
Like, not a respective voice. Like, you know, you say, darling, you know, my this, my that, depending on the language you're using.
Yeah.
So we use beautiful words sometimes. Yeah. Where the other parents, for example, they use nothing.
Yeah.
Right? That's definitely going to cause an issue for a child. Like, when he comes with other children.
All right.
Because a child always measuring. The child is always comparing. That's what a child does. So that's why sometimes you see the child coming to you saying, oh, he has this, I don't have this.
Yes.
Why don't you give me the same thing that he has? So he's constantly comparing, and he wants to have the same as others having. If he doesn't, and if he finds out or he knows that he can't, then like I said, this becomes a problem within him that later
and
on
that
he
comes
will,
out in the form of a fight or some other things. So thank you so much, brother. You said that even sometimes parents need to analyze certain things that could, you know, come up as a fight between the children, and that could indicate the behavior of a child is not normal. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on social media platforms by simply searching Call of Islam Radio. You can also go to our website and listen to our program. That's www.parstoday.com. And there will be a tab, COI Radio, Call of Islam Radio. Until another session, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. And which you gentlemen must endeavor is that you should not be overtaken by pride by the term governor. This term belongs to a time when there is governor and subject, when there is no fraternity and there exists authority and other people are their subjects, whereas this has no place in Islam. Those who govern the length and breadth of the Islam territory, that to a territory so vast that it expanded from Hijaz to Egypt, Africa, Iraq, Iran, and all these Muslim countries that you see. Even some parts of Europe was under its rule. Nevertheless, it was not that their communication with the wage earners was a one that gave orders and one who obeyed them. The noble prophet of Islam, peace be upon him and his family, himself behaved with the people like one of them.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Quran. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has said that the Quran is a man-cultivating book. It is the active man's book. It is the book of human being. It is a book that guides man who is supposed to move from here to the end of the universe and beyond. Now, in this part of his speech, he is referring to a very important point, which is against the main ideology that we see in the West, and that is the ideology of materialism, where they say that this world is a world and after this there is nothing. They only believe in this world. They don't believe in religion. They don't believe in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Even in the socialism and Marxism, we see the same thing. Whereas here, Imam Khomeini is saying that there is something beyond this universe.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi.
Sallallahu alayhi.
Salli.
صلي على طه النبي وآله.
There is something which is in hereafter, and that is waiting for us, and that is the spiritual aspect, that is the aspect which is related to our next life, the life after death. And that is what Imam Khomeini is saying, and he says that this is the book for the person who believes, who is an active man, and who believes that, and who knows from where he came, where he is, and where he will go. So if there is a person who have such belief, then obviously this book is the book of guidance for such person. This book is the book of being a human being. This book gives us the ethics. It teaches us the ethics. It teaches us how to deal with the people. This book commands us to have justice with the people, with the society, with the place where we are living. Even we cannot be injustice towards the place where we live. The nature which is related to this earth, to this universe, we need to take care of everything, because if we want to live in this world, we must be careful and we must take care of this universe. Today, if we see that there is the issue of ozone layer, if there is a pollution, it is because we are not following the footsteps of Quran. It is because we are not doing justice. We are trying to use this world for our own profit. And that's why we see there are many movies that are made that people are living in the skies, in the stars. That is not the way. The way is to live in this earth and to live in a way so that we can have a happy life, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Insight.
Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the legality of the unilateral coercive measures imposed on Iran by the U.S. and the West in a conversation with UN Special Rapporteur Professor Alena Duhan. But first, this brief analysis.
The appointment of Professor Alena Duhan as UN Special Rapporteur examining the effects of unilateral coercive measures on human rights represents a significant victory for the nations of the non-aligned movement within the context of international law and the politics of the United Nations. Traditionally, the US and its Western allies have abused the United Nations, particularly the UN Human Rights Council and the International Court, as tools to further their political and strategic goals in the international arena, with the facade of international law and human rights covering up brutal power politics. In this game, the accused always seem to be countries, governments, and individuals who oppose US policies and strategies, and the world never sees Western governments or elites who have committed war crimes and mass killings. People such as George Bush, Dick Cheney, or Tony Blair, or those who killed thousands of innocent civilians in drone strikes such as Barack Obama, being investigated or prosecuted by these international legal organizations. The United States has gotten used to abusing unilateral economic sanctions as a policy tool whenever it does not know what else to do, because it has no risk domestically and is a convenient platform for US politicians to grandstand for their Zionist campaign donors. Nobody seems to care about the devastating effects that these sanctions have had on ordinary people. With the appointment of Professor Duhan as special rapporteur, the effects of these unilateral sanctions and measures are being examined within the context of the UN Human Rights Council. And this can help global public opinion to examine all sides of the issue based on the reports of a party other than the two countries involved. This might not change the sadistic sanctions imposed by the United States and its vessels, but it does mean that the most important part of the story, namely the facts about the devastating effects that these sanctions have on everyday people in Iran and other countries they are imposed on, will be brought to light by a third party. In a world governed by the law of the jungle, this will not replace Iran and other countries using the many tools of their national power to fight US crimes and power projection. But it does change the factual context within which these debates are conducted, and it might move some countries and societies who claim to follow international law and human rights to think twice before blindly following whatever the United States orders them to do.
Good afternoon, Professor Duhan. Thank you for joining us on Insight. We were scheduled to do the interview while you were in Tehran. Of course, you were very busy. And so, unfortunately, we were not able to conduct this conversation in person. But this is also good. You are now back home, and you are rested, and we are able to have a nice, in-depth discussion about your trip to Iran and what you were trying to accomplish here. So in a way, Professor, it seems to me that this is even crueler than you know, if you're going to have unilateral sanctions, fine, you have it. So this seems to be even a crueler way of dealing with this issue. You have certain things which are technically exempt from these vast array of sanctions that are against Iran, as they should be because of medical and basic human needs. And yet we see there's threats. There's an atmosphere, an environment of threats, of fear that is spread to other countries, particularly European countries. That if a company whose job, whose main function is to sell medicine to countries that need it, and Iran has the money to buy it, Iran is not asking them to give it to for free. Even that country is scared of having one document, one transfer of money that it receives from Iran, because then the U.S. could possibly sanction it in its other businesses. And then adding to that, as you mentioned, so even if that's capable of coming, being able to deliver it, this idea of sanctioning the banking system. And here I want to maybe move to discussing the idea of sanctioning a country's central bank, because as far as I remember, this is unique. We've never had this. If we were going to compare, you know, this economic war to a real war, you could say maybe this is the atomic bomb of economic sanctions, because so much of what a country does is done through its central bank. So if you could please maybe talk a little bit about this issue of the idea of sanctioning the central bank of Iran and how this has affected, devastated, as you mentioned in your preliminary report, the situation of human rights in Iran.
First of all, it's necessary to say that when we are speaking about the banking system, we are speaking about two elements. The first element is freezing money, so freezing assets of central banks of a country abroad.
Correct.
And here Iran is not unique. And secondly, we are speaking about cutting off the banks of a country from the international banking system.
Correct.
As concerns the first part, unfortunately, this tendency is expanding today, and this tendency clearly goes counter international standards of the immunities of property of state. There is a convention on the property, judicial immunity of state property, which clearly says that assets of central banks are assets for the use of the state, and the state exercises its supreme powers and its sovereign powers, including guaranteeing the well-being of population on the territory via having the possibility to use these assets.
Professor, excuse me, I just want to just to explain for our audience. So it is a matter, a settled matter of international law, of international relations, that you cannot have a functioning international system if countries are not capable of using their own resources and assets in other areas of the world. That this is a red line, that countries do not seize and freeze the assets, the sovereign assets of other countries, otherwise the whole system would fall apart.
I will mention that from the point of customary international law, mm-hmm. it refers to the assets of central banks.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I'm not speaking about the assets of commercial banks in specific situation. I'm only talking about the state assets of central banks
Correct.
Being frozen abroad. And for example, recently, me together with some other mandate holders, we have forwarded a communication to the United States as concerned the issue of the freezing assets of Afghanistan Central Bank.
Exactly.
Because due to the humanitarian situation in Afghanistan, the possibility to use this money to provide the basic human needs for these people is very important.
Exactly.
So from the point of international law, freezing these assets is illegal. State shall be able to use it. When coming to the second part, cutting off a state from the international financial system, we come to another package of international legal norms which are affected. Primarily, in contemporary system of international relations and international financial transactions, each of us is very much dependent on the possibility to be able to communicate, to use money, and to tell the truth, I can hardly imagine a sphere of work or a sphere of academic cooperation or private life, mm-hmm. which is not affected by that. So in reality, cutting off the possibility to use banking system is affecting human rights of every single individual, not in the territory of the country which is cut off the banking system, but of other individuals as well, of individuals abroad, and plus of foreigners on the territory of the country.
Correct. You mentioned that you had to bring cash to Iran. To pay for things.
So in reality, every foreigner who is coming, not only me, every foreigner who is coming to Iran can't use the international banking cards. During my previous country visits, like to Qatar, to Zimbabwe, and to Venezuela, I could easily pay with my banking card there, but I was not able to pay with the card in Iran. And in reality, every foreigner coming to Iran is to bring money in cash in order to pay and can't use the cards. That, as a result, is not only inconvenient for individual, but also affect the tourist area in every country, because people are feeling non-comfortable when being not able to use their banking cards. The same cards for the people living in Iran, which can't do any transactions abroad, starting from any import-export operations, so the businesses are affected enormously. Naturally, investors are not interested to come to Iran because of the impossibility or very complicated way to do financial transactions. People can't participate in cooperation. I believe one of the most flagrant elements is when Iran is not able to transfer money to pay the membership fees to international organization. That means it affects the principle of cooperation among states. The same comes to any individual and the same comes to any institution in the country. For example, to academic cooperation, to sport cooperation, to business to participation in international business associations, or to participate in industrial, academic, or any other sorts of conferences. If you need to pay a membership fee, you need to be able to transfer money. If you need to pay for participation in the conference, you need to be able to transfer money. The same comes to booking hotels. The same comes to buying flights, booking flights, and many other elements. Same situation comes to the undermine the possibility to exercise in the due way diplomatic relations between states, because diplomats in Iran are also facing similar problems.
Correct.
And the same international organizations face the same problems because they can't get transfers.
Professor, I want to now go a little bit more in one of the details of the report that you wrote and concerning the U.S. Here you state that you call on sanctioning states, in particular the United States, to lift all unilateral measures imposed against Iran and so on without the authorization of the U.N. Security Council. And you have this interesting sentence, whose use cannot be justified as retortions or countermeasures in accordance with international law. So that, and then in the next paragraph, you talk about, I urge the U.S. government to cease the state of national emergency that is not in accordance with the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. So if you could talk about a little bit the issue of the U.S. and how, in these two examples that you mentioned, their sanctions are in violation of international law.
Generally speaking, sometimes it's permissible under international law to use sanctions in the general understanding. First of all and foremost, the UN Security Council is expressly entitled by the Charter of the United Nations to decide on the use of non-military and military sanctions in the situations when the behavior of states constitutes a threat to peace, breach of peace, or an act of aggression. There was a period UN Security Council we applied to Iran, so
exactly.
Legality of these sanctions.
Exactly. So there was a difference.
Was not disputed.
Correct, Professor. So there was a time, and then there was also between until 2015, and then later the
and then the
correct.
Now no sanctions of the UN Security Council are imposed on Iran, so not at all. When one speaks about the activity without authorization of the UN Security Council, we need to keep in mind that states are always trying to influence each other in one or another way. And some measures which are called sanctions in the media may be legal. For example, so-called retortions, when a state takes unfriendly steps to mm-hmm. another state, but these steps do not violate international law. I will give two examples. First of all, two states negotiate to conclude a trade agreement.
Yes.
And then one state decides, I'm not happy with your policy in this sphere. If you do not change the policy, we will think for a while and won't conclude an agreement right now.
Correct.
Non-concluding agreement in this situation, as far as they have no agreement by this moment, is their decision. It's very unfriendly. It's demonstrate an attempt of pressure, but it doesn't violate international legal norms. So states are free to conclude agreements or decide to not to conclude an agreement. Another case may be under the law of under diplomatic law, states are free to decide whether they like every specific diplomatic agent being on their territory.
Correct.
Or not.
Correct.
And therefore, states may demonstrate its dissatisfaction with the behavior of another state via the decision to close the diplomatic office of this state or to minimize the number of diplomatic staff. And in that case, it will be unfriendly act, demonstrate dissatisfaction, but it's legal. So states can do it. And from the point of international law, it's not sanctions. It's retortion.
Okay, so Professor, excuse me, because I want to state this a little bit more clearly for our audience. So in your legal opinion, there might be a case where we could say that the U.S. sanctions between 2010 to 2015 might have been legal under international law because they were under I don't know the technical term, but they were under the auspices of the U.N. Security Council, but that the sanctions after that, after the U.N. sanctions on Iran were lifted, particularly those after 2018, in your legal opinion, are clearly a violation of international law. Do I understand you correctly?
Partially. When it comes to the period of 2010-2015, it's necessary to take into account that only those measures which clearly fall under authorization of the UN Security Council mm-hmm. are legal. Everything would go, or for example, measures like deciding not to conclude treaty or measures deciding to stop diplomatic relations. These are legal.
Yes.
There could also be cases of countermeasures, so basically violating international law, but in a very, very limited scope. So if you need, I can explain a little bit later in more details. But all the rest is illegal.
So even those 2010 to 2015, it was a mix. Some of them might have been legal under it, and some of them were clearly violations of international law.
Yes.
Okay. And then the 2018 ones, there is no question in your legal opinion that...
When it comes to the period after 2018, again, if there were situations of, for example, stopping diplomatic relations...
Yes, those examples...